Okay, can you hear me okay? Got a very large head, so this microphone is struggling to stay on. Okay, good, we've got the slides working. Okay, so this is the last of three series, as Gabby was saying, on self-control. So this is self-control for the average Christian, and I'm here as a representation of an average Christian. So yeah, we were doing the marshmallow test there, which is an interesting experiment. I've read the first few chapters of the book, but I didn't have the self-control to finish it. But the point, as I understand it, is if you're blessed with more self-control, your outcomes in life are likely to be better. And it seems that some people are a bit better naturally at self-control than others. So on our Elders Away day that we had, we were trying to identify gifts in each other. And there was one elder who we all clearly identified as having the gift of self-control. And it was something that we were all quite jealous of. I won't embarrass Graham Alt by saying who it was, but you might be able to guess. But the point is, self-control doesn't come naturally to a lot of us, but it's a really desirable thing and something that we'd want to grow in. So, one of the verses for today was, like a city without walls is a person who lacks self-control. So that's an ancient proverb. And I guess if you think about an old city in the olden days, your walls were obviously very important because that's what stopped you being plundered by the enemy. If you had no decent walls, if you didn't have your walls built up, then your civilization, your town would come to ruin. And so this proverb is quite clever because what it's saying is, as people, if we don't have self-control, then we can actually ruin ourselves and get ourselves into all sorts of bad states and situations. Self-control is sometimes called a cardinal virtue, which I think means like a fundamental virtue. And it's something that if we don't have, the floodgates can open and we can get ourselves into a bad place. So it's quite a serious and sober thing, self-control. So the cliche when you come to talk at churches, you have to say how great it is to be here this morning. That's what we say. And when people say that, I always feel a wee bit cynical because I think you probably had a bunch of hassle preparing for what you're going to say. You might have fallen out with your family on the way in the car. You might be busy tomorrow. So I'm always a bit sceptical about it's great to be here this morning. So I'm not going to say I feel great to be here this morning. If you look at that picture behind me of the city with strong walls, I think I would feel better being here if I felt like that kind of city with strong walls. But I'm not feeling that strong, feeling a bit crumbly in terms of my own self-control walls. So I think what I'm going to say, you might need to manually help me out though, Martin, is it's somewhat okay to be here this morning. So these are the guys from Lord of the Rings. They're about to defend their city, which is Helm's Deep. And, you know, you can see that they're in the midst of a battle. And for me, with self-control, I feel it's a bit of a battle. I'm in the midst of a fight. Sometimes I get frustrated with myself. Sometimes I get frustrated with others and with circumstances. And it's not something that I ever think that we crack. However, as always, if you take the time to read the Bible and try and spend some time with Jesus, there's hope, and you realise that however crumbly your walls are, you can move on and move forward. So, in terms of the plan, we're going to do four things. So, and you might need to move on again, Martin. I think the clicker's died. So. Okay, it's back to life, miracle. Okay, so we're going to look at normalization. So that is really looking at what the playing field we are practicing self-control is, you know, trying to understand the challenges we face. Then we're going to look at our purpose and why it's important for self-control. We're going to look at Jesus and some of the things he shows us about self-control, how compassionate he was, but also how challenging he was. And then we're going to have a quick look at some holy habits to keep us on track. We'll pause after each one to reflect and ask some questions. So if you're getting bored with me speaking, you'll have at least 30 seconds of respite in between each one. And I'm not going to go into too much detail as to specific issues or tactics, or give you too much personal information. So I'm going to try and keep it at quite a high level. Okay, false dawn. So, Romans 7 and normalization. So, you might remember that verse somewhere in Corinthians where it talks about temptation, and it says your brothers and sisters all throughout the world are going through these struggles. And that's something that comforts us when we're tempted, because we think, ah, I'm not the only one. You know, we all have issues. So I thought it'd be interesting to look at what does normal look like for self-control. So you'll see some pictures of brains behind you. I don't know too much about the brain, but I'm interested in it. So as I understand it, we've got the frontal bit, which is the rational thinking part. And then you've got the limbic bit, which is the emotional-driven, impulsive part. So that's sometimes called the chimp part of your brain. It's a bit which is reacted before your thinking part catches up. So it's a bit that's shouted at someone before you count to 10. That's your chimp part. And I like this picture of Homer Simpson's brain. I identify it with a lot, and we might feel that is like us. And it's funny, that picture, and it's funny when we look at Homer Simpson in self-control, because I think we can all identify with the fact that he's always out of control. It's kind of funny because it's true. But the point is, self-control is not just as simple as having the correct facts and knowledge. That if we just get the rational part of our brain right, then we're going to do great with self-control and it's all going to be fine. Unfortunately, we're fearfully and wonderfully made. And we've got this other part of our brain, which is emotional, impulsive, reactive, and goes off in all sorts of tangents. And that makes being a human interesting, but also makes it very challenging. So that's the kind of landscape that we live in. And maybe sometimes as Christians, we can fall into the trap of, if we just believe the right things and get our truth sorted out, then everything will be fine, and forget that actually we're quite complex creatures. Okay, 50-50 chance there. So, Romans 7, which Gabby read out, I think captures quite well our struggle for self-control. So it's kind of sandwiched between Romans 6, which is a bit of a head-scratcher, but is kind of practical tactics as to how to live a new kind of life and how to control your body. And then Romans 8, which is this amazing cosmic, hope-filled vision of the future. In between those two things, we've got Romans 7, which seems to be a wee bit of a soliloquy on the complexities of being human. So I know some people think Paul's talking about before he became a Christian. Who am I to say if they're right or not? But respectfully, I think they're wrong. I think Paul is talking about the struggle we face ongoing as being a Christian. So if you look at some of the dynamics in play in those verses, there's a whole bunch of contradictions playing off each other. So there's what you want to do, what I want to do, I do not do, what I hate, I do. He talks about I myself doing it versus the sin living inside of me. He talks about the desire to do good and not being able to do it. Not doing the good I want to versus doing the evil I don't want to. No longer I doing it, but the sin inside of me. Wanting to do good, but being accompanied by evil. Delighting in God's law, but having another law at work. So if you read through that, it's quite an exhausting experience, and to live like that, I would imagine, is very exhausting and bad news. But that's why there's a picture there of a man running up a hill with a tire attached to him. It feels like we've got this massive struggle going on. So that is, I think, the world that we live in. But I guess the good news is that God wants to rescue us from that. And there's hope that we don't have to have this experience forever, and that we can grow so that the good that we want to do becomes more natural. So, those verses say, who will rescue me from this body of death? And thanks be to God who delivers me. So I thought it'd be interesting to look at, what does delivery and rescue actually look like? Is it a one-off experience, or is it something that happens throughout our Christian life? So I know we don't remember everything in sermons, but I do actually remember a talk from Annesland College, which for church historians is where West Glasgow met for a while, and it was by Dorothy Hayward, who I think she's in her late 50s now, so she must have been in her late 20s in those days. Anyway, what I remember Dorothy saying is that change is slow, and I remember my ears pricking up at that point, and that caught my attention. And I was wondering why that was, and it's perhaps because I think when you're growing up as a Christian, you hear about all the things that you should do and all the hope, and you think it's going to be dead easy. So I remember thinking, oh, maybe it's going to be more difficult than I thought. But also, I've always been the sort of person who thinks I should be doing better than I am. Even if I do things very well, there'll always be a wee bit of me which thinks, oh, you should be doing a wee bit better, which is a really quite annoying aspect of my character, which I'd like to get rid of, but it's been there for a long time and it's not shifting anytime soon. So the idea of change being slow, I think, is true, and it's a useful one to bear in mind. The truth is that Jesus has rescued us, but we're also in the process of being rescued, and that takes time. So going back to the brain analogy, when we become a Christian, we don't get a free lobotomy. We've still got our old brain. We've got our old habits that die hard. It's hard to take on new ones. If you look at the graph in the middle, it's not about the Christian life, but the same principles apply. We're not on a constant upward trend to glory. Things happen. We have setbacks. We think we're doing well. We're riding high in April, and then in May we're shot down. That's just the way life is. And that's the landscape that we work through. So that might sound a bit depressing, but if you think of the parable of the mustard seed, that's what Jesus does. He works with us where we are, and he slowly changes us so that eventually we'll have a tree with big branches on it. And he's put in us the mustard seed of his spirit. Sometimes we can lose that, but he knows what he's doing, and he is rescuing us throughout all the setbacks that we might have. So that is a good time just to pause for half a minute and think about these two questions that will come up. So just have a think for half a minute of what areas you struggle most between what you want to do and what you actually do, and if there's anyone who can help you with that. Okay, that gave me a chance to have some coffee, which is something I struggle to control, ironically. So, second thing we're going to look at was the importance of purpose in terms of self-control. So, I was thinking of some of the self-control type stuff that I see around society that seems important. So, having a shredded body at the gym seems to be very important to people at school. Eastern Bertonshire have a free gym policy now, so if you go to the Allender Sports Centre in Bearsden, you'll be surrounded by young people, which is really good. Quite often they're having a complete laugh, but one thing I have noticed when I venture into changing rooms is quite often there'll be groups of teenage boys with their tops off, sort of flexing in the mirror and taking pictures, and I think, jigs, in my day, they would have been, well, we wouldn't have tolerated that sort of behaviour, but today today is something that's acceptable, and it's obviously very important to people that they look good, which is good. It's good that they're at the gym. Or I guess when you're working, you might look at kind of managerial tips or inspirational leaders who you want to follow, and they'll put stuff up in their Instagram or whatever, and they'll say, yeah, I wake up at 5 o'clock, I do hard work, I do some reading and journaling, then I do some exercise before I'll check my email over an avocado sandwich. That's the sort of thing that self-control looks like in society, I think. And lots of these things are good things in their own right. Of course, you could use these things to justify yourself or and so on, but there's nothing necessarily wrong with them. Although I do think Jesus probably would rather we were loving and get up at 8 o'clock than unloving and get up at 5. The point is, I think we need to think clearly about what self-control means for Christians rather than just accept whatever the latest fad is. So in that regard, I guess our purpose in the Bible is pretty clear. It's to love God and to love others. So love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. And the second rule is to love your neighbour as yourself. Those are the two most important commandments, and they're our guiding principles. So if you think of a boat with a rudder, love is our rudder. That's what should shape what we do. And that should be the rudder that shapes what self-control looks like for us. So if you think back to those examples, you might say, I want to have a six-pack to feel good about myself and validated. Or maybe a more loving way to frame that would be that you want to stay healthy. So as far as it depends on you, you can be active for the people you love and for God in the world. Or you might say, I want to get on top of my finances so I can get that new pair of curtains that the neighbours will admire. Or you might say, I want to govern my money better so I can use it for good. You might say, I'm going to go to church because I've been indoctrinated and I feel guilty if I don't go. Or you might say, I'm going to go to church because I want to try and help someone this week. So for me, it's a bit of a paradox that if I focus on the minutiae of self-control in my life and what I'm doing wrong, I start to lose my heart, I start to lose direction. But when I put it in the bigger picture of my purpose, which is to love people, I start to forget about myself a wee bit and make a bit more progress. So to me, knowing our purpose and knowing that it's to love can help us forget about ourselves and actually grow paradoxically in self-control. So that's sometimes can't remember who it was, someone said that this is a bit like the expulsive power of our new affection, and that's a fancy way of saying it. Just don't stop doing one bad thing, you have to take on something good as well. So it's about being caught up in a bigger purpose and that helping you. So I have a friend who goes to the church, but I've anonymised with Liz McCogan's face because they're very shy. But they recently ran a half marathon. And anyone who's done any sort of running or training, well, know that it could be the training bit can turn into real joy because it kind of changes the pattern of your life. Your diet changes, your sleep changes. You've got kind of motivation every day to get out and do something productive. Your whole life changes because you've got this kind of bigger purpose. Or, recently, 6 months ago, I got a new job, which I've very much enjoyed. And I found myself kind of not dreading Monday so much and kind of getting out of my bed, 10 minutes early and thinking, yeah, I'm going to start the day because I had a new purpose. Now, we all have to work for about 40 years, so I'm not expecting that to be the state of play forever, but a new purpose can really motivate us and change us. And I think with self-control, rather than, again, just look at the individual issues, what we need to do is remember our big purpose and what God's purpose for our life is. And actually, sometimes that means self-control will take care of itself. So if you think through your life stages, school, work, kids, retirements, all the joys and sadnesses that happen, what is your purpose? at that point. So we're going to think about that now for half a minute. Just a dead easy question, what's your purpose? But maybe think through, you know, what is it you enjoy doing that's good, that you feel maybe God's given you gifts in? That's maybe a place to start. And maybe think how knowing your purpose could help you in your self-control journey. Okay, so we'll speed up a wee bit. So we're actually most of the way through, so don't panic. So Jesus and self-control. I guess there's no doubt that Jesus did possess great self-control. So rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place and prayed. I sometimes feel that I'm being like Jesus when I go to Hillfoot Station early in the morning. It feels quite desolate. But that's kind of CEO behaviour. He's getting up dead early and being productive. But he's a kind of unfathomable mix of compassion and challenge when it comes to self-control. On one side, you've got stuff like, I've not come to call the righteous but sinners, a bruised reed he won't break. Can the wedding groom fast while the bridegroom is with them? So, not rules, rules, rules. And then you're thinking, this sounds like a great person to hang around with. And then you've got all these really very difficult challenges, like, whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. So, you know, you're then thinking, okay, this isn't just someone who's going to be scratching my back the whole time. This is, a challenging person. But then I think that's why we love Jesus, because he loves us so much that he's good to us, and he's good, so good to us that he won't allow us to destroy ourselves like a city without walls. So one thing that struck me as I was reading through for this, if I'm ever stuck preparing for something, I'll tend to just read through one of the Gospels and see if I can pick up any stuff. So I was reading through Mark on Friday, and I was really struck for the first time about the way that Jesus cared for people. You might think, Jings, you know, you're in your 40s, you're a slow learner, but it just really stood out to me. So I was looking at these verses, I think in Mark 6, and the context of them is he just sent the disciples out to go and, you know, evangelize, I guess, and they were coming back, and they're just about to feed the 5,000. They don't know that yet. So they've been doing lots of really exciting stuff. And what I was struck with was just how he actually cared for them. So if we go through these, the top verse, the disciples are dead excited to come to Jesus and report back. You know, people were doing all the rest, all these interesting things. But they were really busy and they had no chance to eat. And so Jesus, rather than saying, that's great, right, here's your next job, or that's brilliant, how do we capitalize on this great run of form? He says to them, come with me by yourself to a quiet place and get some rest. So he's looking after them. He knows that they're not machines. Soon after that, they get interrupted by a large crowd. And again, Jesus is always balancing care for everyone, so he realizes that they're like sheep without a shepherd. And, you know, later on he'll say, these people have been with me for 3 days and they've had nothing to eat. So he has compassion on those wider crowds. But the thing that he does straight after that is he makes his disciples get into the boat and go away. So he was flexible to care for other people, but in the context of that, he still had in his head, these disciples need a rest. And I'm guessing they must have had some great times on that boat. It sounds like good fun to me. So he was taking care of them. And then after that it says, after leaving them, he went up a mountainside to pray. So he was taking care of himself as well. So that might all seem dead obvious, but to me it was really very struck that if we want to be serious about following Jesus and self-control or whatever, then I think one of the big things he's going to say to us is, look after yourself and just make sure you do that. And I don't think he would be impressed with us not looking after ourselves to do Christian things. So that really struck me, and I was challenged by that. You might not have been challenged by that, but you've got half a minute to think about it anyway. And then we'll move on to the last bit. So what practical things would Jesus want you to do to take care of yourself, and how might that help you with self-control? Okay, so we're one slide and a wee meditation left, so we're going to get there on time. Well done. So Mary Smith wants me to say that there's a prayer meeting tonight at 8, and I'm about to forget to say that, so I'm saying that now. It's a prayer meeting tonight at 8 to kick off the 247 week, or to help... Mary Smith wanted me to say that the 24/7 prayer starts at 3 o'clock this afternoon, and it's a church prayer meeting that starts at 8 o'clock tonight. Okay, good. Thanks, Mary. I did say to Mary, heckle me if I forget this, so that's all in that context. So I just wanted to think very quickly to leave you with three holy habits that might help us to grow in self-control. And just flag up three ones that have helped me or do help me, and you can run with them if you'd like to, or think of other ones. So very quickly, community, not going it alone. So I think we need to be proactive about meeting people who are good for us, especially when life is tough. I have a few people who do that for me, and I'm very grateful for them. And I find it very refreshing. So keep going with community. I'm the sort of person who, when Jesus says, go up on a mountainside and pray, I'll be right there. But when he says, you know, where two or three meet together, I'm less keen on that. But community is important. And then prayer. So it seems to me if self-control is a fruit of the Spirit, then prayer is key in that. How else can we connect with God? So although I had the dates and times completely wrong, we do have a good chance this week to get stuck into some prayer. Mary and her team have been beavering away very hard in the background making this 247 week happen. And if you go to your yellow sheet, you'll be able to get a link where you can book a slot for an hour a prayer. You might think I could only do 10 minutes. I don't think anyone's going to be with you checking. But that might just be a good thing you could do to get that done. And then in terms of purpose, I guess, you know, people talk about journaling and all these things these days, but I do think writing down our high-level purpose is helpful, and maybe having a mission statement for yourself and then going back and checking it can help correct a lot of wrongs self-control wise. So that's really all I had to say. You'll be pleased to hear. I like a bit of poetry, so I was looking around for a poem which might have some themes about self-control, and I found one which I thought was good, so I'm going to read it to you now, and then we'll stop. Well, actually, before I do that, you just have half a minute to think about holy habits and self-control. Is there a habit you could intentionally practice in the next few weeks to help you with self-control? Okay, thanks for listening. I will read this poem which I found, and then we'll stop. So this is a poem about encountering Jesus. I was fixated by what hand to cut off and which eye to gouge out, troubled by how to carry a cross of wood when I myself am a crooked timber. I came to him, the king. He said, come with me by yourself to a quiet place and get some rest. On the way to that quiet place, I met many who were weary and many who were burdened. I asked him, the king. He said, bring them also to that quiet place. And so, together, we rested, and he taught us many things, too many to write down. Our hands were at peace, our eyes were only on him. He spoke to our hearts, and they burned within us. Later, he asked us to carry a cross. It was heavy, but together we bore the weight. So, thanks for listening. That's all I have to say. So I will scuttle off now.